Thank you. Wow, this after yesterday, this just feels like boundless luxury here. This is great. Going forward. Okay, so yesterday I left myself a piece of unfinished business. I was talking to holomorphic this, holomorphic that, and then at the very end I said, and maybe you should care about meromorphic stuff. And I didn't define what meromorphic stuff was. So that's what I want to start today's lecture with. However, I'm going to dissolve this. Oh, fixed. Let's take this. So, as a sort of compromise and to keep things a little bit simpler, today I'm only going to work in dimension two. So X will be a compact Kähler surface. All right. Some of the things, actually, a number of the things I say at the beginning are going to work in any dimension, but it's not really that important right now. Okay? So, the first thing I want to address is, what is a meromorphic map? All right? And I might, I mean, to answer the question, maybe what I'd like to ask is, what is a holomorphic map? And the point of view yesterday, the Gromov point of view, is a holomorphic map is something that's given by its graph, okay? So you have, for a holomorphic map, here's X, you have some graph for the thing. This would be what I was calling gamma 1 yesterday. And the thing, you have the projections onto the two axes, and the thing that makes it a holomorphic map is that, well, first of all, this is a complex subvariety, but secondly, the projection onto the first coordinate is just an isomorphism. If you think of the graph as a complex manifold, it's really just X, okay? So this projection is bijective. So the definition of meromorphic map comes from loosening this condition up slightly. So what you do instead, so here F is going to be pi 2 composed pi 1 inverse, okay? And if pi 1 is an isomorphism, F is holomorphic from X to X. Is holomorphic. So for meromorphic, you just require that pi 1 from gamma to x be a proper modification. I'll say just a modification here, so it's long enough to write like that. And let me, so I want to define modification too, and I'll just define it by example. So it's an example we've already seen. So the thing about a modification is it's like an isomorphism. It's essentially a biholomorphism everywhere off some subvariety of gamma. So definition, pi from x hat to x hat to surface 2, is a modification if pi 1 is holomorphic, surjective, and it has connected fibers. Okay, and so I'm taking advantage of compactness of everything here. If you have open manifolds, you've got to attach some other conditions to this definition here.
Does it have to have the same dimension?
Yeah, that's why I put surf under next to the x hat. That's supposed to be surf. I'm supposed to indicate that that's, yeah, otherwise you know, it's a fibration or something. Okay, so the first example, and in some sense in dimension two, the last example of a modification is a blow-up, e.g., so given P in X, you have the blow up sigma from X hat to X, such that the pre-image of P, which I tend to denote E for exceptional curve, is actually a curve. It's biholomorphic to P1. And elsewhere, you have a biholomorphism. Okay, and this pretty much specifies what a blow-up is uniquely here. Okay, now the fact, I said it's the first and in some sense the last example of a modification. The fact is that in dimension 2, any modification say pi from x hat to x is a composition of finitely many blow-ups. Pick a point, blow it up, look at the new surface, pick a point, blow it up over and over again. That's your modification. This is badly not the case in higher dimensions. It's much more complicated than this in general. But it's nice in dimension 2. Okay. So now you have some idea of what this definition means for a meromorphic map. The deal is the picture. Where should I do this? Is something a little more like this, where pi 1 is nice most places, but there are some sub-varieties in the graph that get sent to points. All right? And so I'm cheating slightly in the definition here. So one thing that happens is gamma does it. If you take gamma to be the literal graph of the thing, it doesn't have to be a smooth variety. You do want it to be irreducible, at least. And then by desingularizing, you can arrange that it's smooth. So I'm always going to assume I'm working with a desingularized graph here. So that thing doesn't actually sit in X cross X. All right. But anyhow, it's a minor point as far as I'm concerned. Right. So a little notation associated with meromorphic maps. You have the indeterminacy set of F is the image of all these curves that are collapsed by pi 1, okay? Okay, so the curves are dimension 0, pi 1's collapsing them. This is a union of points, so this is just a finite set of points. Where F is not defined. F is trying to send these points to curves. All right. So let's see. You also have what I'll call E of F, the exceptional set of F itself. So that'll be pi 1 of all the curves that pi 2 sends to points. So there might be some curves in here. The picture might be a little more like this. Okay, there might be some curves sent by pi 2 to points. And then what F will do is take the image of that curve and send it to a point in X. So this cuts both ways for meromorphic maps. You can collapse some things, you can blow some things up under a meromorphic map.
Your definition completely obvious, that in the general setting high is by itself points. I mean, in case kind of obvious, but
Completely obvious. Well, right. So these curves will be critical for pi 1. So gamma would be a compact variety, or compact manifold. These will be critical. So this is a compact set. It's the image of a compact. Yeah. Nothing is ever obvious. I mean, you have to, you just think about these things once and then you pretend they're obvious for the rest of your life. Or think about them 10 times in my case. Okay. So I have many small points I'd like to make, and I'd like to make sure I've made them. That's pretty good. So questions about the definition of meromorphic map. Let me just stop. Okay. So these guys aren't maps. I'm going to pretend they are. But you have to worry. And the first thing you might worry about is the following question. So yesterday I made a big deal about how the linear action of a holomorphic map on cohomology was so relevant. Okay? So second question is how, not what. How does a meromorphic map act on cohomology? Okay? And the answer is somewhat more carefully than a holomorphic map. You have to be a little careful about this. So any cohomology class is represented by, say, a smooth closed PQ form. And if your memory is good and you think back to yesterday, you're going to realize right away that all I care about is PQ is 1-1 or 2-2. So a volume form or a form that could conceivably represent the class of the fundamental class of a divisor in your complex surface. Okay? So how are we going to, say, pull that thing back? Well, with your pi's. So F star alpha is equal to pi 1 lower star, pi 2 upper star of alpha. And the first part of this doesn't need any comment. You pull back forms. That's what you do with forms. The second part needs a little bit of comment because you don't normally push forward forms unless you've got something decent, and I don't. I have a map which is collapsing curves. But you can switch points of view and think of this form as a current. So this is push forward in the sense of currents. Yes, and I'm assuming, well, P, yes, that's right. Gamma doesn't really sit next cross-section because I smoothed it. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, good point. Right. It's confusing otherwise. Yeah. Okay, so you pull the form up and you push it back and you get F star alpha, which is not the same sort of creature. It's a current, but it's still, by this or that duality, it still represents a cohomology class. Okay, it's still, well, let me not get to cohomology right away. Let me just make a couple of other points first. So similarly, you can push alpha forward. I mean, if you can do this, you can also do this. So you got pi 2 lower star, pi 1 upper star alpha. That's not a problem. So more generally, you can define the pullback and push forward of a divisor or a positive closed 1-1 current okay notice I'm rapidly getting fixated on the 1-1 case, and that's really going to be where I work in most of the talk. The 2-2 case turns out not to be such a big deal. Okay, and with these things, so when you get a pullback divisors or currents, the problem is exactly the opposite. Pushing forward a current is natural, pulling back, not so much. The thing is that for divisors and currents in codimension one, you have essentially potential functions. Curves have defining functions, and currents locally can be written as DDC of something. So what you do is you pull back the defining function and take DDC here, or you pull back the defining function for your divisor, and that defines a divisor. Okay, so these things, you can define these things too, okay? At any rate, so you always have that F upper star and F lower star commute with D round D and round D bar, okay? And so you get corresponding operators. F upper star, F lower star on the Doble cohomology groups of X, or the Durham cohomology groups, whichever you care to have. Okay? I guess domain and target. Okay, so what I want to say next? Right. So what are these operators? Well, in the 2-2 case, there's not much to say, all right? The 2-2 cohomology group is generated by any volume form, all right? So what F star does here is multiplication by some number lambda 2, which is equal to the topological degree of F, or the number of pre-images of a generic point in X. This is the end of the story. And by lambda 2, I really do mean the lambda 2 that I had yesterday, the second dynamical degree. So, maybe this will clear up a little bit of mystery surrounding dynamical degrees. In this case, it's just something every topologist would recognize immediately. All right? And in particular, there's no limit involved in computing this dynamical degree. It's just there. All right? Ow. Okay, now you can sort of think of F upper star on H11 in the same terms. All right? So F so now consider F upper star on H11 of X in some sense. So now you're talking about cohomology classes of curves or something like that. So so in some sense, this is an operator which measures the way in which F inverse changes. Really the cohomology class, but in particular the area of complex curves. Okay, and you have that this first dynamical degree from yesterday is the limit as n goes to infinity of f to the n upper, the norm of f to the n upper star to the 1 over n. And I'm very careful with the parentheses here. You'll see why in just a second. The parentheses are important in the limit. Okay? Right, okay, so I'm saying all the good things I can think to say about the actions on chronology here. I'll watch my time a little. But I'm rapidly getting to the point where I have to break the bad news to you. Do I have anything else? Right. The nice thing to say is that F star, you've got this, you can pull back positive closed currents and get other positive closed currents. So the cohomology class of a positive closed current goes to a corresponding cohomology class. So F star, so H11 PSEF, pseudo-effective of X, which is a set of classes of positive closed 1-1 currents, is invariant under F upper star. Okay, this is a very strong fact because so the set of such classes, you can't have a class represented by a positive closed current and then have negative of that class represented by the positive closed, same positive closed current. So these guys form a closed strict convex cone in H11 of X. And strict means that the cone doesn't contain any lines. All right. So the picture is this. You've got this cone in H11, and F just maybe takes a little bit inside itself, or maybe exactly onto itself, or something like that. Okay? So this is what you have. And in fact, this is not the only such cone that you care about. Another one you get I see. Well, maybe it's the build strength. I'll just stop and do this a few times. No. Okay. So there's a little more good news here. You have pretty much automatically first of all, on a surface, one of the nice things you have going for you is this intersection product on 1-1 cohomology. And in some sense, pullback behaves well with respect to intersection. Okay? So F star alpha intersect beta is equal to alpha intersect F star beta for every pair of 1-1 classes. And this follows almost immediately from the definitions. Both of these guys are equal to 1-1. You just pull both forms up to the graph and intersect there. And that's the same as either one of these guys. Okay? So what that means, among other things, is that not only is this cone invariant, it also means that the dual cone is invariant. So corollary to this adjoint property for F upper star and F lower star is that the dual cone of the PSEF classes is invariant. Okay, these are called the NEF classes, and NEF means different things to different people, actually. Numerically effective is the first phrase I heard, but it's also numerically eventually free or something like that. Okay, so this is the cone that you get from taking classes of Kähler forms, and that's not a closed cone, so you take the closure of this. And Kähler forms are certainly positive, so this second cone sits inside the first one. So these are both strict cones, both convex, both closed, and they both have non-empty interior. All right. So by a sort of weak form of Perron-Frobenius theorem from linear algebra, there exists a class beta plus in H11 snap of x such that S star theta plus is equal to what for the moment I'll call R1 of F theta plus. Which is the spectral radius. So this R1 is the spectral radius of F upper star. Okay? So somewhere in there, there's a class that's just invariant on the nose up to, well, up to scaling, I guess. Okay? Now, if you're sharp, you'll immediately wonder, why am I bothering with the R1? Why do I not say lambda 1, because isn't this, after all, computing the spectral radius of F upper star? That's where the problems begin. So, warning, in general, if you have two meromorphic maps, say F and G, G composed F star is not the same thing as F star composed G star. Okay? So this is a problem. And the example to keep in mind, the one, it's pretty telling, really, is F and G are a blow-up and it's inverse, all right? So let's say I have to draw the picture to remind myself how this goes. So let's say you pick a point P in X. You have what I was calling sigma before, which blows down a curve to P, and then sigma inverse blows it back up, okay? So if you take, a Kähler form over here, in x hat, okay, then clearly sigma composed sigma inverse star of the Kähler form is itself, right? Sigma composed sigma inverse is the identity. On the other hand, sigma inverse upper star, which is really sigma lower star, composed sigma upper star of omega, well, let's think about this. So you pull back omega, it's now a current, and it's badly singular. It has a positive Lelong number at this one point. Maybe you can believe that. It gets concentrated here. So it acquires the sort of density of a complex curve at this point. And then you pull back again, and what happens is it's as if you're pulling back a complex curve that went through this point. You pick up a multiple of the exceptional divisor right here. So you get... you get omega plus the intersection of omega with this exceptional divisor times the exceptional. So you get something bigger than what you do if you pull back by the composition, right? And that's a general sort of phenomenon. Okay. So, and in fact, this is geometrically exactly what can go wrong for you. So Fornes and Sebony observed a long time ago, not so long ago, 10 years ago, that G composed F upper star is not equal to F star G star on say, Kähler forms. Kähler forms are good things to consider. Precisely when, or let's say, if and only if, F collapses an exceptional set in such a way that it overlaps the indeterminacy set of G. Okay, that's exactly what's happening here. Okay, so if and only if this intersection is non-empty. Okay, so there's a nice geometric criterion for when this fails. All right, and maybe in the spirit of proposing things for you to think about in the future. In higher dimensions, You certainly have this phenomenon too, but the water is a lot muddier in higher dimensions. You don't, in particular, even in codimension one in higher dimensions, it's a little unclear to me what's happening, but in higher codimensions, and pullback doesn't behave as well on positive closed currents. It's unclear what sort of geometric condition there would be that could get you equality here. There's a whole lot to think about right there, I think. So if you're adept with three-dimensional complex manifolds, three-folds, it might be something to consider worrying about this sort of problem. Okay, so bad. So here is a theorem that's actually due to me and Fav from now we're less than 10 years from the present, but maybe not a whole lot less than 10 years. If f from x to x is bimeromorphic, then in some sense, for purposes of iteration, you can always fix this sort of problem. Okay? So then there exists a modification pi from x hat to x lifting f to a map f hat from x hat to x hat, still bimeromorphic. Bimeromorphic, by the way, just means it's meromorphic and the inverse is meromorphic, so that second projection, that pi 2, is a modification just like pi 1. Okay, so lifting f to a map f hat with a nice property that if you pull back by f hat to the end, that's the same thing as pulling back by f hat n times. Okay? And opening a can of worms maybe here, but everybody has their pet name for this property at this point. And I think one of the maybe the original name, or nearly the original name, given to it was algebraic stability. All right. So you have, under iteration, pullback behaves well. Okay. So this implies immediately, if you have this, this implies that this spectral radius of f upper star is the first dynamical degree. So in this situation, f hat. Okay, the first dynamical degree of f hat is really just the largest eigenvalue of f hat star. You don't need to iterate to compute the first dynamical degree either anymore. Okay? So this resolves this sort of problem fairly well in the bimeromorphic case. So for non-invertible f hat, it's not clear how well things work. Things meaning this theorem, whether or not you can just blow up a bunch of points and then make the thing algebraically stable. Okay. There certainly is a counterexample, but the counterexamples are fairly special at this point. They involve just monomial maps, and you could maybe hope that they're the only counterexamples if you were. You let yourself dream a little bit. But as far as proofs go, there's a recent result of Fav and Janssen. So that says that the theorem works for meromorphic maps that come from polynomial maps, just extending polynomial maps of C2. Okay, and the proof, actually I should say just a word about the proof of this theorem, okay? But the proof of this result is far more complicated and involves some really nice ideas that I never really saw before Fav and Janssen started using them. Okay, so let me say just one word about the proof of this theorem. And the word is actually going to... Yeah, you extend the map as a, you take it as a, extend it to P2, and then it's a meromorphic map that does bad things to the line at infinity.
Lambda 1 of F hat is the same as lambda 1 of F.
What's that?
Lambda 1 of F hat is the same as lambda 1 of F coin, both coin.
Yes, in fact, that's right, right, yeah. So the thing about dynamical degrees that gives it this an advantage over the spectral radius is that, they don't change under bimeromorphic conjugacy, okay, whereas the spectral radius does change. Alright. Okay. Well, I won't really prove the theorem, but I'm just going to draw a picture which is very similar to a picture Eric drew yesterday. So what is the problem you run into when you don't have this equality? The problem is, by the geometric criterion I stated, the problem you run into is, okay, I made my point, this. You have that F collapses a curve which marches along in the disguise of a point and then is eventually blown back up to another curve, okay? So in the very simplest case where it just, this is a blow up and this is the inverse of the blow up, it's fairly clear you just resolve the problem by blowing up all the points in the middle here. Okay. Now in general you can have blow ups of blow ups of blow ups and there's a bookkeeping issue that comes in, but it can be handled. Alright, so this is it. This is essentially the idea, the proof of the theorem. In the case of bimeromorphic maps. And as far as I know, most of the people who've looked at this and then gone to thinking about the non-invertible case go through this 15-minute period where they tell themselves, but wait a minute, doesn't the argument just work in the non-invertible case? Try it. And then you think, then you go to bed and you wake up and you realize, no, it doesn't. And the problem is that the problem really comes in because in the non-invertible case, you also have ramification in the critical set. And if that gets in the way, it's really hard to tell what's going on. Okay? So anyhow, that's as much as I'll say about that particular problem. But I will assume from now on, maybe I'll just work in the bimeromorphic category. So from now on, and I'll make some side comments about other classes of maps. Meromorphic. Okay, and there another side remark is that this is the model case for say even non-invertible maps F with what we call small topological degree, i.e. the first dynamical degree beats the second one so that the action is all happening on H11, or the interesting stuff, the most interesting stuff is on H11, okay? So if you work out this case and then you can see how you'd like things to go in this case, which is substantially more complicated. But let's just assume F is bimeromorphic. And algebraically stable, what the heck? Okay, so there I pointed out one problem with pullback. There's another one, all right? And the other one can be resolved in a somewhat more, well, I think it's a little more satisfactory resolution, okay? So another problem is that if you pull back a wedge product of 1-1 forms, Okay, if F were holomorphic, it would just distribute over the wedge product. But in general, this is not the case. Okay, this is not the same as F star alpha wedge F star beta. Right? And in fact, in some sense, this guy is bigger. If you take alpha and beta to be Kähler forms, you're going to tend to get that this guy is bigger than this one. And again, the thing to think about is the case of point blow-ups. So, how shall I do this? Right. So sigma from x hat to x is a blow up. Okay, so in going forward, sigma is holomorphic. And if you pull back by sigma inverse, the wedge product of two Kähler forms, so omega Kähler. All right. Well, you get something which is sort of mildly singular at the image of the exceptional set. But the singularity, this is equal to psi times the volume form, where psi is integrable. Okay, so it's essentially a volume form. Okay, on the other hand, if you do this, okay, then you get everything that you had before. Whoops, I should be using sigma inverse. Sigma inverse. You get everything you had before. But both of these things are currents with positive Laplace numbers at the same point. And from general pluripotential theory stuff, this means you're going to pick up a delta mass at the point you blew up, some constant times a delta mass. Okay, so you get a little more when you do things this way. All right? So once you notice this fact and you pay some attention to the constant and you do a little inductive thing using on this fact that a proper modification is a composition of blowups, you get the following sort of generalization of this fact. So in general, you have an arbitrary meromorphic surface map, and you pull back two forms and take their intersection, or you pull back two classes, take their intersection. You get the topological degree. I'm breaking my promise to stay to the bimeromorphic case here. But you get the topological degree times the intersection of the two classes, plus, so that's this part, plus a quadratic form involving alpha and beta, where the quadratic form is non-negative. So it's a quadratic form such that it degenerates on a class alpha if and only if alpha dot C is zero for every curve C that is in the image of a point of indeterminacy. Okay? does that make me left-brained? The right half didn't get it to say. Okay, yeah. So where this thing degenerates if and only if the intersection with everything in the image of the indeterminacy set is zero. Okay? So I said before, then I would have a nice satisfactory resolution to this problem of not distributing over intersections. And the reason I say it's satisfactory is you can actually prove quite a bit from this formula here, okay? So I don't have a whole lot of time to say things, but I can maybe give a couple of indications of things you can prove. Okay, so let me put that thing to work. Let's suppose that lambda, not necessarily the first dynamical degree, lambda is some number that's bigger than the topological degree of F. And you've got a class, theta, that's an eigenvector for pullback with eigenvalue lambda. Okay? Then if you pop that into this formula, what it tells you is that lambda squared theta dot theta intersect theta is lambda 2 theta intersect theta plus q of theta theta. Okay, which tells you, actually, if you solve for theta dot theta, that this quantity is greater than 0 with equality, if and only if, first of all, Q degenerates at theta. So in other words, theta has no interaction with the image of the indeterminacy set. All right? So all eigenvectors for eigenvalues of a certain size have positive self-intersection or non-negative self-intersection. And if lambda is lambda 1, but theta is not a multiple of what I was calling theta plus before, the sort of first eigenvector for lambda 1, then this implies that there exists a two-dimensional subspace of H11 where the intersection form is positive, or non-negative, I guess I should say, is non-negative. Okay, but there's a general fact. I mean, the fact about the intersection form on a complex surface is the signature, you only have one positive eigenvalue, okay? Everything else is negative, so this is impossible. Okay, in fact, if you look at the classes of things with non-negative self-intersection, it sits just between the NEF and the PSEF things, and in fact, I guess, in this case, negative something with positive self-intersection still has positive self-intersection, so that cone has two pieces to it. But it doesn't contain two-dimensional subspaces. Okay, so this is impossible. And the most general thing you can prove using arguments like this that I know of is approximately the following theorem. Lambda 1 of F is the unique root counting multiplicity of the characteristic polynomial for F upper star such that its magnitude is greater than the topological degree. So there's only this lambda 1 really stands out in the spectrum of F upper star. Okay. So you can prove that. Another thing you can do, can I do it? Yeah, I got a few minutes left. Another thing you can do in a little bit different direction using this formula is uh, you can come up with a criteria to sort of detect when you're dealing with a holomorphic map. Okay? So theorem, if you have a bimeromorphic map, it's algebraically stable, and this thing is bimeromorphically conjugate to a holomorphic map, if and only if the self-intersection of theta plus is zero. I think that plus has been migrating up and down, so sorry. It just goes wherever I want to, wherever it's convenient to put it. Okay. So if and only if the eigenclass for the first dynamical degree has zero self-intersection. Okay. And I don't have time to say much about the proof. All I'll do is point out that if F is holomorphic, then this is fairly trivial. If F is holomorphic, then you really do have this property of being able to distribute F star over wedge products. So then you've got F star theta plus, F star theta plus is lambda 2 theta plus dot theta plus. And lambda 2 is 1 in this case. And that's lambda squared theta plus dot theta plus. And there is no extra term because there's no indeterminacy set to interact with here. Okay? And since this guy, lambda 1 is bigger than 1 and lambda 2 is equal to 1, that's your only choice. Okay? Now to go the other way, if you have something with this property, what you need to do is start getting rid of indeterminacy, and you use this thing to do it. Okay, there's a criterion for collapsing curves which interacts well with that criterion. I mean, with that sentence over there. So dot, dot, dot on this proof. I can't resist saying, if F has small topological degree, the same theorem is true, except the holomorphic map conjugate to F might live on a singular surface. Okay? And there's another project for anybody who's thinking of something to do is to, so tomorrow I'll talk about sort of analytic details or use some pluripotential theory to actually do dynamics again for bimeromorphic maps. And when I do that, I heavily use the fact that the thing is smooth. So there's maybe some question about what you would do if you were in a singular setting. Here, it might be worth thinking about. I don't know. Singularities scare me, so I haven't considered it. All right.
If the theory had lambda 1 bigger than 1, has that been the case ever since the Diller-Bob theorem?
Oh, right. I should add that as a hypothesis. Okay? No, not at all. Not at all. There's no assumption at all about lambda 1. Okay? In fact, that's a good... I'll state one more result that deals with exactly that case when lambda 1 is 1. I'll just state the theorem to just try to impress you with the utility of all these spectral considerations. Okay. So let's suppose f from x to x is binomorphic and algebraically, do I even need this? Now let's just say binomorphic, you can make it algebraically stable. Then either, you have several things. Lambda 1 is bigger than 1, so there's not much more to say about that. That's really the generic case, the case where you have interesting dynamics. And in most cases, that would imply, we know for sure that that implies that the topological entropy is greater than 0. There's some corner cases where we don't quite know that. So another possibility is, well, the other one is lambda 1 equals 1, but you break that one down. So another possibility is that if you look at f to the n upper star, and it turns out to be bounded independently of n, up to binomorphic conjugacy, you have f to the k is holomorphic and isotopic to the identity. Okay, so it's nearly the identity transformation if you just take an appropriate iterate. You can also have that f to the n upper star grows linearly, constant times n. So again, up the conjugacy, f preserves a unique rational fibration. Of x, okay, and you can also have that this thing grows at a quadratic rate, and then f preserves a unique elliptic fibration. Of x, okay? And then that's the end of the story. You don't have cubic growth or anything like that. You just have this, which is, if you think about it, a little bit parallel to what happens when you do classification of surfaces, all right? And you're looking at growth rate of sections of the canonical bundle if you take powers or something. Okay? This is a good place to stop. I'll end here. Questions?
Yeah, thank you very much.
That's sorry. Usurper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why not cubic growth? Can I give an easy answer to that? I don't remember all the details right now because this is actually the hardest case and ends up relying on some, to get the fibration you need to use some sort of obscure, to me, results of Giza-Tulin. But essentially it goes back to the fact that the signature of the intersection form is one and then a bunch of minus ones, okay? And the deal is what happens, the way you get the quadratic growth is when you have quadratic growth, the theta plus sits right on the edge of the positive cone. It's right on the edge. And then you have to, this corresponds to having a Jordan block of size, 3 or something like that. So you look for the two generalized eigenvectors. And I think the first one sits inside the positive cone, and the first one sits in the tangent plane to the cone at theta plus, and then the second one sits inside, and then there's no, the third one would have to sit inside too, but it can't. You can't have too many things going on inside that cone, right? I think that's the way it goes. I won't swear it.
Other questions from us? If not, then let's thank the speaker first of all.